lounge lizard. So if I stand up and break into a Tony Orlando imitation, just humor me. Just happens with microphones. I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1987, and after doing everything that I knew how not to drink. And so it was the last stop for me. There was nowhere else for me to go with doing what I was doing for a living. I couldn't go to a detox or a rehab. Really couldn't go. And so I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned how to mechanically stay away from alcohol. It's funny because this is, I was first at this home back in, I want to say 88, 89, 90, when my daughter was a baby. We used to come up here. I was married at the time, and we used to come up to Vermont, and I came to the house just, and she was talking about earlier, I was here when they were jacking that wall up, you know, and because I somehow made the connection, Vermont, Bill, it's got to be somewhere, and managed to find it. And so to be here this afternoon and have this opportunity to share with you is a you know, particular honor and privilege for me. At a year or two sober, whatever I was at the time, the thought that I would be doing this when we talk about beyond our wildest dreams is just beyond my comprehension. And so I want to thank you. And Heidi's going to start talking about step three.
Great. Really want to actually thank, I just prayed right before the meeting with a woman that I sponsor, and you know, what I love, one of the things that I love about this program is that really Steve and I, you know, we got together a couple times and really talked about what we were going to talk about today, so that, you know, we kind of knew. I mean, it's great. I feel comfortable with him, and I think that you feel comfortable with me. And, you know, a lot of what we talked about was that, you know, what's so amazing as you go through the book is that, you know, on the one hand, once we hit chapter four, from what I can see, which is we agnostics, from this point on, you know, our case has been sealed. Okay. Doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there's a solution and more about alcoholism. You know, the last sentence of more about alcoholism basically closes the door on any kind of argument that we can do this ourselves. You know, oh my God. I just need to read this line again because it sends shivers up my spine. The alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Now, when I first read that, you know, we're kind of going back just for a minute, is when I first read that sentence, I mean, I remember reading and being like, oh my God. Oh my God, you know, a drink is going to jump into my hand and jump down my throat. I mean, it would scare me so bad. I thought that, you know, I think that my view for a long time of sobriety, that it was like, it was some kind of a crapshoot, that like John Barleycorn was going to come and like, come and like jump out from behind something and get me. And it's taken me a long, you know, and I've found that that's a feature of alcoholism, that there's this belief that no matter what I do, you know, John Barleycorn is lurking around the corner, you know, and I just share that with you because there's a lot of the language in the big book is very like, we must do this or else. And I believe in that wholeheartedly. And I have come to believe for myself that, that it's not about a fear-based thing. And I've had to really, you know, part of step three is really getting my own conception of a higher power, one that I can live and breathe with, and one that I really want to go to when I'm scared that I'll pick up a drink. You know, one that I can, that is going to work for me. And I've had to, you know, later, as we get into the chapter, it talks about really asking yourself, what do these spiritual terms mean to you? You know, and a lot of times what I talk about with the women I sponsor is like, wow, that sounds like a pretty punishing higher power. How's that working for you? You know what I mean? So let's just start at the beginning. So so far in the book, I feel two ways about this. I'm going to say, like, hopefully at this point in the book, I've bought in to the fact that I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows, and that, you know, I believe that I need a higher power at this point. Like, hopefully I've bought into those concepts. I think that's vitally important. However, I also know for me that, you know, it's less important to kind of argue with myself. I think another feature, at least for me, of my alcoholism is that I can spend a lot of time going, do I really believe or do I really know what? You know, it's just, okay, just get on with it, right? Okay, so at the opening of We Agnostics, basically at this point, hopefully I have a belief that something else besides my thinking can work for me. So now I need to put that belief and start building faith. One of the things I learned about the word agnostic is that it means without knowledge. So before I work the 12 steps of AA, I am without knowledge. You know, Steve referenced being dry. You know, I was dry, and I've been dry. The first time I came to the Wilson House, I was coming off of like a, you know, I sort of spun off my axis. Steve, you just jump in anytime because, you know,
My reference is a little bit different in that I came to the rooms with Alcoholics Anonymous and for years stayed away from alcohol. I had a sponsor that grabbed me early on, and you know, it was in the first week or two that I was making meetings, and I got to tell you, I was blessed with this man. He doesn't do what we do, but I just still believe I was blessed with this man. But we had the God conversation early on, and the way he imparted the information was such that, you know, do you have a God? And in my case, I was just dumb lucky enough to get here with a God. I'd been busted up a bunch of times and just believed that there was a reason why I was kept alive. I did not make that connection to my disease. I did not make that connection to my alcoholism. And what the conversation, brief as it may have been, was, you know, do you have a God? And the answer was yes. And he said, no, I'm serious. Listen carefully. Do you have one? And the answer was yes. And he says, well, don't ever forget that, because there's going to come that time when the only thing between you and your drink is going to be your God. And I never did forget that, and that day did come. And so, as wrong, and I hate to use the phrase wrong, but as different as it is from what we believe today, if you're sitting in this room and this is your first access to this, it's important to know that this is done, you know, Hattie has mentioned in a very specific way with the, you know, the first step. And as we're getting into it now, we're getting into the second, third step, that thought that as long as I went to my God that I would be safe always worked for me. I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous many years later after having lived in the fellowship. You know, and so when we get to agnostics, and for me, you know, it's a revelation to me, and it still is, and I've done this hundreds of times with other alcoholics. It's not uncommon to have 15, 20 people in my dining room, you know, on a Monday night, every Monday night. And so when we get to this point, you know, it's, and we find out early on who's the atheist, who's the agnostic, you know, who thinks there might be, and whose God is the barbecue king, and, you know. And so when we get to this point, we have that conversation again. When we talk about three and people having a problem in three, we always go back to two. The problem isn't in three. The problem isn't with your God. The problem is in two, that you're not willing to take that step. But is the problem really in two? Because if you're having a problem with two, are you not believing that maybe you can fix your alcoholism?
Mm-hmm. Just to sort of really reference some important points of this chapter. So on page 44, we have here simple definition of the alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. So those are two questions that we can ask ourselves right now. And I can ask myself that question on a daily basis. Closer to the mic? Okay. Both of us? Okay. Basically, the book goes on down. You know, it tells us, you know, three times, an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Then, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. You know, that was such a revelation to me when I first read that. And it still is. There's no option three there. You know, that's, okay, alcoholic death, you know, or spiritual basis. And, you know, I think that alcoholics are the only people who would ever say, I don't know. Let me think about that. You know, I'm not sure, you know. That's why I need a 10-step personally. And then on down, you know, face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. And again, this is what differentiates a real alcoholic, an alcoholic of my type, from someone who's a hard drinker, you know. Okay, so one of my favorite lines that, you know, right down here at the bottom, cheer up. I want everyone to ring around. In my sponsorship family, we say ring around. So just put a circle around cheer up, because really, like, there's a lot of seriousness in the big book, but it's also very lighthearted, so you need not be disconcerted. Ron, you're shaking your head. Over on the next page, on 45, you just jump in.
Our human resources as marshaled by the will were not sufficient. They failed us utterly. And what that means to me is, if you can fix yourself, just go sit in a corner and fix yourself. This is not a problem of your will. And it's important to note that. If you can do it, go do it. You don't need to be here. The problem with the rooms of Contemporary Alcoholics Anonymous is that the person sitting next to me may or may not have the same disease that I have. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when they're telling me that this is okay, you don't have to do this right now, you can wait a while, you know, you can get better before you go through the work, instead of going through the work to get better, they might not be suffering from the same disease that I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember my first sponsor pointed at me and she said, lack of power, that is your dilemma, right? So the first three chapters and the doctor's opinion have rendered us powerless. So what are we going to do about it? Well, this book is here to tell us we have to find a power greater than ourselves, and it's going to teach us how to do that. So from now on, we are into action. It's the power. This will enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. You don't have to have my power. You can use your own power that you are going to find through your work. And that is so, that took me so long to get. Let's see, turning the page. Steve,
And so the next 10 pages are about how to find that power. Mm-hmm. And that line on page 45 is actually one of my favorite lines, when it talks about that's exactly what this book is about. And so when I got here and I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was looking for, you know, Roger shared earlier, where's the direction? Where's the part? You know, where is that part that tells me how I get better? Like, just show me those pages and I'll be good to go. Right. And so what I learned when I read this is, exactly what this book is about is how I come to a God, a loving God, an understanding God that's going to help me with all my problems. It doesn't say alcohol. It says my problem. And that could be whatever your problem is. You know, at 21 years sober, my problem ceases to be alcohol. There are several other problems that occur in the course of my day. And those problems are what I go to my God for. Those of us that are sober for some period of time, it's still the same program, whether I'm 21 days or 21 years.
I think it's also a really important point that the book is making here in terms of a third step, is that, you know, all I really need is willingness to take that third step. You know, I don't need to understand a God. I don't need to have the perfect God. Whatever kind of faith I have is enough to begin. And it says that several times. As soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves. I can still be fighting. I can still be arguing, you know, but all I have to do is having even a willingness. And the book is promising us that I can commence to get results. And I found that to be true for me. Over on the next page, on 47, there's a very important sentence. It says, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe in a power greater than myself? And, you know, I use that sentence today when I'm in a jam, you know, because I get jammed up. And I need to go back to these basic questions. And I can ask myself, okay, Heidi, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe in a power greater than myself? And if the answer is yes, then I can take the next right action. I just want to say, too, that, you know, my first sponsor, Annette, and I always share about Annette because she saved my life. And just to backtrack a little bit, you know, like I mentioned, I was 16. This woman was 73, and we were inseparable. She was my best friend. And we both had alcoholism, okay? And we spoke in the language of the big book. And how she used to put steps 1, 2, and 3 is, step 1, do you think you're an alcoholic or not? Step 2, do you think AA can work for you? And step 3, are you going to do AA or not? Simple as that. And that really appeals to a person like me, who can just overcomplicate the heck out of everything.
And so that line on page 47 was, do I believe or am I willing to believe? That's the opening. That's the clearing. That's the space. You know, it's funny. When I talk to these, when I speak in meetings, I don't know who in this room is a newcomer and who in this room is sober and been through this work 100 times. And so my inclination is always to talk to the newcomers. So if I sound simplistic, humor me. I'm sorry. But the truth of the matter is, if you don't have any experience with this, this is your spot. This is your place where I can say, okay, maybe. Mm-hmm. And that's all it takes. Okay, maybe. You know, and then we can go from there. And on the bottom, when it talks about the appendix.
Page 47. Appendix 2, right. Spiritual experience.
And, it's important to note that on 25 and 27, there's the same note. You know, and then by the time you get to 47, it's please be sure to read. You know, he's trying to make a point here. Like every other points in the book, he repeats himself 3 or 4 or 5 times sometimes just because, personally, I don't think he's such a great writer. I mean, but in terms of literary skills, but all the information is here. And his only way of making that point is to repeat himself. And so if he repeats it 3 times, trust me, there's something there he wants you to see. And so when we go to that, which we didn't have a chance to early because of time, and I'm talking really fast because this is like the Evelyn Wood version of the third step. it talks about the psychic change and the spiritual experience. And it's important why he's doing it at this point, again reiterating it, because this is it. Heidi talked earlier about this is where the rubber meets the road. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to move forward. I don't know how to move past this without that opening. You know, and I just don't know how to do it. But and so I've always had the experience with very few exceptions that we were always able to get someone to that place where they said maybe or okay, I will.
One of the things that that I work with a lot is, in just a few pages and how it works, they're going to talk about how our old ideas have to be abandoned or else the result is nil until we let go of them completely. And really what the next few pages are really dealing with are, you know, we've been handicapped by obstinacy, sensitiveness, and unreasoning prejudice. That sort of thinking has to be abandoned. And what I get out of this and what the books is saying to me here is that any old ideas I have must be rooted out, at least for a little while, long enough to get me into action, okay? Long enough to get me basically to pick up my pencil and start writing my 4-step. It goes into this whole prosaic steel girder, and I don't know if anyone else, but the first time I read that, I was like, whoa. Like, it was like, oh, you know, I just didn't get it at all. I still really don't get it, but that's okay. It's basically the book is appealing to people who aren't sure. And, you know, I was sure about some things and other things I wasn't so sure about. I love this line on page 49. I always like to point out the parts in the book that are so encouraging and so loving and so just they give me a boost. Instead of regarding ourselves as intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation, so I just have a little note to myself. That's me. So all of us sitting here have the chance to be spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation. I'm sorry, but that was never, you know, even a thought on my radar when I was, you know, drinking my face off at 15. Let's see. Over on page 50, there's this great line that says, in our personal stories, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. Back on page 29, there's also... it sort of says something the same thing, and it's talking about the stories in the back of the book. It says each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. Somebody pointed that out to me when I was going to be I had to speak for 30 minutes, and I was like, oh, my God, what do I talk about? I'm so scared. And she said, well, the big book says that the stories in the back of the book talk about how each teller, you know, that their AA story is how they establish their relationship with God. So that tells me that that is what my AA story is, and it really is. So I just wanted to point that out. And it tells us that each person can have a different approach. you know, and that these are really questions for each individual to settle for themselves. And, you know, the sponsors that I've had have given me suggestions on how to pray. They've given, you know, directed me to the book, or they've told me what works for them, but they've never said, this is the kind of God you need to have. You know, it's been about, you know, me continuing to do the work so that I can feel that little, you know, and that's what it is. And we're going to get to that on page 55, what that little is. Right, Steve?
Right.
Okay. Go for it.
And so, you know, and it consistently talks in these next few pages about the presence of God. The interesting, you know, and when we move on to page 52, I got to tell you, early on we were in the forwards and we were reading the doctor's opinion, and it was talking about that irritable, restless, and discontented feeling. And so, you know, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, many years away from a drink, that was who I was. I was still irritable, restless, and discontent, years away from alcohol. So what that tells me is that, you know what, alcohol wasn't it. I hadn't made that connection at the time. I knew I had better breath, but I was still exhibiting all the same behaviors, you know, still angry, vengeful, and, you know, just generally malcontented. And so when we get to, you know, when we turn to page 52 and we're down the middle of the page and we see the bedevilments, you know, we ask ourselves these questions. You know, do I have trouble with personal relationships? Hello. You know, do I find I can't control my emotional natures? Yeah, two arrests for aggravated assault, 10 years away from alcohol. Do you think? You know, am I prone to misery and depression? Yes. You know, and so that was years and years away from alcohol for me. Uh-huh. And I'm, you know, and maybe it's not like that for you. Maybe it was all hearts and flowers when you weren't drinking. It just wasn't that way for me. And you know, the real kicker for me, when somebody sat down and had this conversation with me before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was still in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was like, oh my God, he says, well, what they're talking about here is an untreated alcoholic. They're talking about an active alcoholic. I was like, oh my God, you know, how much plainer could it be for me? And so, you know, it talks about the basic solution of these, you know, of these bedevilments. And when we saw that they could solve their problem by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, I knew that there was hope, and there was help available. And my experience with this book is almost on every page throughout the book is that there was always hope. And wherever we are given some uncomfortable information, in the next line, two or three, there's more hope. And so there was hope for me.
Over on 53, you know, they talk about how it's not by accident that we were given the power to reason. And that was an important concept for me to understand that, you know, basically the book is, again, encouraging me. You know, obviously sometimes I have to just be an automaton and just say, okay, awesome, I'll do it. But thank you. And, but, you know, the book is really asking me to search diligently within myself, you know, and to ask questions. And you know, more sane and logical to believe than not to believe. I mean, why did I end up in Alcoholics Anonymous? Because my way wasn't working. It's not, you know, it's not my sponsor. I sometimes, you know, my sponsor will say, don't ask, you know, don't have me tell you what to do. Look at your own inventory. Look at your own history. You know, that's your best teacher right there. What doesn't work for you? You know, and down here we come to the step three proposition, Steve.
You have to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or he is nothing. And you just can't make it any plainer than that. There's just no maybe in that statement. Okay? And if you're at that point and you can look at that, God either is or he isn't. What's your choice to be? Choose. You know, earlier it talks about living a spiritual life or an alcoholic death. Oh, gee, wait, let me consider. You know, and that's where we are. You know, if you're at this point, that's your proposition. Either God is everything or God is nothing.
Again, on 54, the book closes another loophole for anyone who's saying, well, I don't have faith. I'm not a worshiper. you know, basically it's telling us, like, yeah, you have been a worshiper. And I have a little note to myself and how I understand this whole passage about, you know, had we not worshiped people, sentiments, etc. You know, I worshiped alcohol. I had faith in alcohol. I had faith that if I took a drink, I was going to feel better. I had faith that if I flirted with your boyfriend, I was going to get attention and get, you know, self-esteem for about 60 seconds. You know, I had faith that if I took money out of my dad's wallet, I was going to, you know, be able to take my older friends out. I had faith in all those things. So what the book is appealing to us here is that I had to learn to take that faith and put it into something else, you know, which is a tall order. For some, you know, for us who have been living on self-sufficiency. Let's see. So we need a new kind of faith is what the book is telling us. On 55 is just, this is where the book is telling us where we find our higher power, which is, I don't want to read the whole two paragraphs, but deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. We found the great reality deep down within us. Wow, what a revelation. You know, when I look into your eyes, I'm looking at God. So just look at somebody next to you right now. You're looking at the great reality. I mean, this is serious. You're glimpsing the great reality right now. Okay. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. You know, and basically, you know, the book goes on to say that if we can just think honestly, search diligently, and join these others on the broad highway, we cannot fail. That even if I'm not totally 100% sure right now, that the consciousness of my belief is going to come to me. And to all of you, Steve.
We come to a place, the end of the chapter, where it talks about God restoring my sanity, and it closes with, He has come to all of us, who have honestly sought Him. And my experience and my truth is that that's absolutely accurate. When we draw near to Him, He disclosed Himself to us, or herself to us. And that has just been absolutely true.
One of the prayers that we said, you know, this woman and I who prayed right before the meeting, one of the prayers that we said is, you know, again, I'm really into taking these words out of the big book and making them come alive, you know, in right now. How can I use these things to work in my life right now to continue building faith? And so we said in our prayer, we said, God, we are drawing near to you. So we trust that you're going to disclose yourself to us. So there's a prayer right there. Okay, we're going to get into how it works now. You know, we won't read all of how it works.
Yeah, we don't have the time. But does anyone here, or let me see, who here has not ever read the original manuscript of How It Works? Anyone? Okay, cool. And so the original manuscript, the original writing is significantly different than what we have in the book today. And we'd like to share that with you after the meeting. We don't have time, but we just think it'd be interesting for you to see.
Yeah, it's non-conference approved, just for the record, but
which is why we're doing it after the meeting.
Exactly. But so just we'll start going through how it works. I just actually want to share one thing about how it works. A lot of times chapter 5 is read at the beginning of meetings. And one thing that I learned, it's another tool that I use today in my sobriety, is when I got sober, I got sober with these two guys, Armin and Gary, and they were great. And Armin just celebrated 33 years sober, and they were like my buddies. They would, like, you know, explain the big book to me, you know, in a sniveling mess, you know, after the meeting. And my home group was called the Here and Now Group in Port Angeles, Washington. And we would always read How It Works. And I would always see, and Armand at that time had about 17 years sober, and I would always see him when the time would come at the beginning of the meeting to read How It Works. I would see Armand following along with his, you know, 17 years sober, this guy. And so, of course, I learned as a newcomer to always follow along. And it's something that I still do today. I just wanted to pass that on because it's been a helpful tool to me, not to just sort of, you know, they're reading How It Works, like I can, you know, text message. That's just for me. Okay, so this first word, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I heard one time, you know, again, this is kind of off the record, that, you know, Bill Wilson apparently said that the one word he would have changed is rarely to never. You know, but basically what they're telling me is that I have just, everyone has the same chance here if we do the, if we take these actions, and it's all laid out here in the book. And it talks about completely giving themselves to this simple program. Another expression that I hear a lot in AA that I just want to pass on is that thing, this is a like simple program for complicated people. I heard somebody put it so well. For years, I thought, oh, I'm so complicated. I'm so complicated. And I heard somebody say, this is a simple program for people who like to complicate things. I thought, oh, my God, what a relief. I don't have to hang on to that identity of I'm this, like, crazy complicated person who can't get this program. I just have a bad habit of complicating the hell out of everything. Steve?
After how it works, it starts talking about the requirements. And so, you know, in contemporary and popular AA, we, you know, there are no musts and there are no this and there is no that. And, well, no, there is musts and there are requirements. And so, we read about the requirements. And it talks specifically, in my experience is such that it's absolutely accurate that, you know, my life was run on my self-will. The truth of the matter was I was at the root of my problems. But, again, we get back to that thing, so what can I do about it? Well, I can't do anything. The fact of the matter is, I'm just, you know, it's a sick mind trying to heal a sick mind. We heard it earlier. So I had always run on self-will, and it's hard, you know, so how do I just, you know, stop doing that? I can't, is the point. And so, you know, we learn more and more, and we get into, you know, where it starts talking about selfish and self-centeredness, and that's where I lived. My truth is my whole life was centered around being and doing for me.
I just want to go back on page 59 again. I like to find things that I can use right now, today, in all times of my sobriety. There's one that has all power, that one is God. May you find him now, right now, at this moment. Sorry, I just wanted, I think that's really important. And that also, you know, the ABCs, alcoholic and cannot manage our own lives. No human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and that God could and would if he were sought. That means, you know, I can have Bill Wilson himself sponsoring me, but if I'm not willing to do the work, you know, he can't remove my alcoholism. Ron can't remove my alcoholism. You've tried. It doesn't work. I know, exactly. Okay, so Steve was mentioning what are the requirements, you know? Well, you know, hopefully I'm sold. You know, are we clear on these requirements? You know, do I believe I'm an alcoholic, and do I think the program can work for me? And am I ready to decide to do the program? I mean, that's pretty simple when I put it that way. I really love that. Begins to talk about the actor, and, you know, without going through the whole thing, you know, this is basically, it's laying out the cycle of a self-centered person. You know, whether I'm being nice about trying to get my way or whether I'm being a jerk about trying to get my way. I mean, it's self, self, self. And, you know, and I can usually gauge when I get, you know, when I've been in self is if I'm hung up in the results. Things don't go my way. And if it stings a lot, you know, I didn't get my way. And I may have been really nice trying to make that happen. And I love this, producer of confusion rather than harmony. I mean, that's the story of my life. Chaos, like a freight train running through the lives of others. On 62, it tells us what the root of our problems are, selfishness and self-centeredness. And this is just from my personal experience. One of the things that I like to share about a lot is, you know, like I said, I was really lucky and am so grateful that I got to get into the book early on in my sobriety. And for years, I read the book as this very punishing, you know, selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our troubles. And like, you're a bad person. And, you know, and I got sober with people who would say, everyone was, you know, older than me. And I got sober with some people who would say, like, I'm a sick, self-centered son of a, you know what. And so I thought that I was, I mean, and that probably works for some people, but there was something going on in the way I was interpreting that, like that I'm a bad person. So again, just like we talked about in the doctor's opinion, this is not a moral issue. You know, this is an illness. You know, it's a spiritual malady that I have. And so I just want to pass that on if anyone has that similar issue. It's basically just telling me that, you know, in the past, I place myself in a position to be hurt, driven by 100 forms of self, whether it looks nice or it doesn't look nice. You know, and again, Steve references this. How do we get rid of self? With God. Like, I can't will myself to be unselfish. It's just impossible.
Okay. And so, you know, and it goes on to talk more about how we have to have God's help. And that's really, you know, but at this point in your recovery, at this point in the work, you're either there or you're not. And they're still talking about how, and my experience is that I need to, at this point, turn my life and my will over. There's just nowhere else for me to go. He spent these last X amount of pages explaining to me all the reasons why and all the ways that I can do that. You know, and we're at that point now when he talks about if we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer being all powerful. And it's interesting to note the phrases and the words that he chooses to use, you know, principal, director, that, you know, none of them are damning, none of them are, you know, punishing. They're all kind of, you know, leadership positions that are there to guide us, you know.
Step three, a lot of people, I mean, I know for me, I spent a lot of time, you know, being like, is this God's will? Is it not God's will? You know, that whole, like, is it God's will if I turn right? If it's God's will if I turn left? You know, what's my will? What's God's will? You know, that whole thing. And, you know, does anyone else here ever go through that whole, like, you know, what's God's will? You know, and I asked God to give me an intuitive thought or direction. It didn't come, you know. And one of the my favorite things that my sponsor said to me one time, she said, you don't work a step like you take a Quaalude, you know. It's just not like that. And so a lot of times for me, what I've learned lately, you know, and God, I am so thick. It took me this long to learn this in sobriety, you know. For so many years, again, this very black and white thinking, I thought that there was a right choice and a wrong choice. And then if I made the wrong choice, that was it. God wasn't going to be with me. John Barleycorn was going to, you know, and I was in trouble, right? And, you know, because there's that line that says, you know, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. So I read that as like, well, if we don't keep close to God and perform his work well, I guess he's not going to provide what we need. Which again, like, what a punishing God. I have to go back and wait a minute, Heidi. So what I have learned is this whole like God's will, my will. And I just pass this on if anyone else has this sort of hang up is, you know, I do my best in the moment to make the best choice I can. You know, I do my best to do what I think he would have me, what God would have me. And if it turns out later that I was full of delusion and I made a wrong choice and I was running on self, I believe today that my God is loving enough to help me right that situation. You know, that there are no mistakes in God's world. I mean, maybe there's mistakes, but that God will then give me the strength. I don't know if God really cares if I go right or left, or God really cares if I buy the lip gloss at Sephora or not, or if, you know what I mean? It's more about what am I going to do? How am I going to bring God into these decisions and then make the best decision I can in the moment and then go and try to be of use in my life.
I, on the other hand, have been told repeatedly not to buy the lip gloss at Sephora. Just the way my God works in my life.
Wow.
Strictly an Elizabeth Arden kind of guy.
Can I get his number?
And so we're at that place. And so, again, I don't know who I'm talking to, and I don't know who has experience and who hasn't. So I'm just going to take a moment, and I'm going to share with you when I'm at home, you know, how we do this. And maybe later we'll get the opportunity to share together. You know, picture a dining room crowded with people and so what we'll do is we rise and we hold hands. And everyone is asked when they're ready to take this step at their leisure. And so we'll all stand together. And there's been, you know, as few as one person, three people, up to 20 people. And from, you know, 2-3 weeks sober to 22, 23 years sober. And everyone, when they're ready, will recite the prayer as it's given to us. And then we will all share it together. And I got to tell you, it's such an intensely moving experience. I get chills talking about it. I really can't put it into words, but it's brought several grown men to tears, because it's the power that's around us and with us and for us, you know. And so, you know, when it talks about how this is the way that we get past those fears and get past those delusions and get past all of that will and self that's been driving us into the ground all of these years, this is the way out. And it's almost like a relief. And so it's at this point, you know, I'm a firm believer that I can go to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and get relief, or I can come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and get freedom. And so when we get to three, we start to experience freedom. We have hope in one and two. And in three, we start to experience, you get a taste, you know, you get a taste.
Also, you know, step three is, you know, again, I believe that this, for me, this program needs to be renewed daily, hourly, by minute. And so, you know, rather than, you know, a lot of us learn the third step prayer, you know, and it's easy just to kind of every morning, you know, offer myself to thee, you know, blah, blah, blah. So a couple things that I found that work for me in really living a third step are really thinking, you know, really trying to think about what I'm saying, number one. Also, you know, sometimes I found that using my own, changing the thee and thy, you know, whatever I think, you know, I've experienced like whatever I need to do to make that expression of really making that decision, you know, and then what happens is, you know, it doesn't really wax philosophical really at all after we take this third step in the book. It says next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. And Steve and I talked about the word vigorous. It's not passive, you know, it's, you know, it feels really good to sort of sit there, oh, I just turned my will and my life over the care of God. But I know for me, if I'm not careful, I've thrown the towel in, I'm going to yank the towel back, you know. So I need to, now is the time when we get it out into the fourth step. You know, the book is great. It makes this great comparison. It's a fact-finding and a fact-facing inventory. For anyone who has written an inventory, you know, hopefully you experienced that. I know for me, like I did hear people saying like, oh, the big bad fourth step, it's so scary, I'm in my fourth step, you know, and it was this, you know, it's kind of tragic, dramatic thing, right? And so I was like, oh my God, the fourth step, this is like major. You know, but I gotta say that once I started to do it, I had, you know, it's like with each step, what the steps allow me is this feeling that like the more I keep going, it's like the more I have that feeling that like, oh my God, my problem could be solved, you know, maybe I could be getting better, you know. And I know for me especially, like everybody has things, you know, reasons why they don't feel like they fit in when they come into AA. And when I did my inventory and finally did my fifth step, that's when I felt like I was no longer benched. Okay, I was on the field and I was playing. Right. And really, like what I want to say again is that the fourth step isn't like, let's look at what a piece of crap Heidi is. Let's look at what a bad person she is. Or let's find out how, you know, how horrible I am. It's just a fact finding and a fact facing process. And one of the things I heard is that if we really go with this whole business thing, you know, that it's just the object is to disclose damaged and unsaleable goods. You know, I put these things out on the shelf because I think they're going to sell. You know, I put manipulation out because I think it's going to work for me, and it does work for me for a long time. I put stealing out because I think it's going to sell. I put not balancing my, you know, being dishonest with money. I put being promiscuous. I put down being, you know, self-centered because I think it's what's going to get me what I want. And for a long time it does, until it doesn't. And that's why that's what is called alcoholism, you know? So it basically the three different manifestations of self that we're going to look at specifically in the fourth step are resentment, fear, and sex. And it talks about resentment is the number one offender, and how, we have been, spiritually sick. And, you know, I'll talk about resentment in a second, but this is one of my favorite lines: when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And that's a really important point. I know there are times in my sobriety where I think the problem is I got to get a better job. I got to get more money. I got to. And what the book is telling me is it has been my experience that I need to work on my spiritual malady. You know, it doesn't mean I don't take action in other areas of my life, but a lot of times there's something when I have that kind of, I gotta get, you know, there's a spiritual malady going on. There's a spiritual sickness. When it talks about resentment, what is a resentment? Sometimes I hear people say, and sometimes I even think like, oh, I'm not resentful. I don't have any resentments. Re-feel, right? And a lot of times for me, what I have found helpful is if there's any, when I'm making a list, is if there's any stories that I have to tell. I'm a big storyteller. It's like, you know, I found for me that there's certain stories that I don't think consciously I'm resentful about them. I'm not resentful about the fact that, you know, my dad, you know, did X, Y, or Z. But why, you know, it just happens to come up in conversation over and over and over again. But I don't have that inner ping. No, I don't. You know, but the truth is, so I found that's really helpful. If I'm feeling like, oh, I don't have any resentments, or if I'm working with a sponsee who's like, oh, I don't have anyone I'm really mad at. You know, I say, okay, well, what are some stories that you find yourself telling all the time? Steve, oh my gosh, you have 5 minutes left for the fourth step.
So it's important to note where it talks about vigorous course of action, and the next paragraph talks about it once. There is no delay between 3 and 4. You go from 3 exactly into 4 immediately. Do not stop at go. Do not collect $200. Start writing, okay? And if you have a sponsee, or if you yourself are in a position where, you know, you're a little uncomfortable about 4, and, you know, you've heard all about the boogeyman in 4, your sponsor will allay those fears. I mean, when we sit down with people, I explain to them, you know, they talk about one door closing and another door opening. 4 is the hallway before the door at 3 and the door at 5. And when I'm in that hallway and I'm alone, it can be a scary place. And newcomers forget that they go into 4 with their God. You see, we are no longer alone. And so when we're sober many years, we take our God with us. We take our higher power with us. We take our creative intelligence, our spirit of the universe is with us all the time, all day. When you're new, that is not a practiced behavior. And so it's important for them to know that they don't ever do this alone. And so when they start writing, there's a simple prayer. I ask them to write on the top of the page, "Dear God, please show me everything I need to see." And it's a reminder that we never go anywhere alone anymore. And so when they start writing, they're writing with that power behind them. I don't ask them to qualify their thoughts. The first, just get the paper and we make a list. There is no conscious thought to it, a stream of conscious writing. I don't want you to qualify whether or not you're really pissed off at that person. You know, if the name comes up, you write it and you just keep writing. We don't have a lot of time, so we're not going to have the time to get into the nuts and bolts of it. But what happens in 4 is where we start to work. You know, 1, 2, and 3 have been all in the mind. Really, either you're making the decision or you're having the understanding, and you're making the decision or you don't. In 4, you're going to take a real hard look at who I've been all my life. You know, it talks about digesting some chunks of truth about myself. In 4, I get to see that I am my problem. I am the root of my problem. alcohol wasn't the problem. It specifically tells us, and it's so true. It's this symptom. So for all of those years in the fellowships of Popular Alcoholics Anonymous, I was treating this symptom. And I couldn't understand why I was still so insane. And it all became so terribly apparent to me and for.
One of the things that it talks about is, you know, it talks about the world and its people. We found in doing this four-step that the world and its people were often quite wrong. You know, and that to conclude that others were wrong was usually as far as most of us had gotten. And I know that was definitely true for me. And what happened is I came into the program and times when I'm untreated, you know, is that people keep, you know, wronging me. You know, and I heard this great expression, if you meet three jerks in one day, who's the jerk? You know, and you know, and that really speaks to me because, you know, every now and then, like, I'll have a day when it just seems like, I can't believe this is happening to me again. It's like, oh, okay, well, what's the common denominator here? And what I found is one thing that Steve and I talked about is like, do you do four columns? Do you do five columns? Do you do three columns? Blah, blah, blah. Check boxes, you know, everything. It doesn't really matter. I mean, the book gives us a pretty clear format. We're going to list the people. We're going to list, you know, why we're mad at them. We're going to list the instincts at play. And just to give you, you know, I'll give you an example in a minute, and then we're going to finally get down to like, well, what do we really have to do with this situation? Now, I want to just talk about something that is an important part of the four step. I hear a lot of people get hung up on like, well, I don't have a part in, you know, the fact that I was abused, or I don't have a part in. Okay, there's some things that I don't have a part in. I'm going to share. Okay, so for years, those of you who know me and are close to me, I've written out 10 steps, and I'm so scared to say this, but I've written out 10 steps with about in regards to my mother, and what is my part in any of her behavior and in her struggle, you know, and in her. You know, the things that have gone on in her life. I don't have a part in that. You know, it's nothing to do with me. I didn't cause any of that. But what is my part in the resentment? What is my part in the fact that I'm 33 years old and I can't let it go? I'm an opportunist. I'm using that as an excuse as to why I can't get ahead in life. I'm using it as an excuse as to why I'm scared of intimacy. Whatever that means. I'm using it as an excuse as to why I don't have to really work as hard as other people because I have this crappy thing going on. It's really hard. You don't know, right? And that's where I get down to. So I want to make that differentiation that when we talk about what's our part in the resentment, it's not about what's your, you know, what did you do to make that happen? You know, because it talks about setting in, you know, how fear makes us set in motion trains of circumstances that we felt we didn't deserve. It's not so much that I set any trains of circumstances for her or for another person. It's that what is it in me, you know, 20 years later, or what is it in me, you know, now an adult that I don't want to let that go? How am I using that? And the problem is, you know, Steve and I talked a lot about when we were going through this about how, you know, this is different than a non-drinking program. However, the book brings it right back to drinking. What is the problem with a justified resentment? Because, whoops, if I have a justified resentment, the insanity of alcohol can return. It shuts me off from the sunlight of the spirit. And if I'm shut off from the sunlight of the spirit, I'm in danger of drinking. You know, maybe not right now. But if, you know, if I let that stuff fester, and for me to drink is to die. And it taught, you know, this line too, like, I'm just going to keep going for a minute. You know, we had to be free of anger. And again, like, I had a long time in AA that I thought, oh, I'm not supposed to be angry. So I walked around going, you know, I'm fine, you know, I'm fine. You know, I really thought that the book was telling me you can't be angry. And it's saying I have to be free of anger. You know, obviously, I'm a human being today with a full range of emotions. But what am I going to do about those feelings? You know, how can I work through them in a constructive way? You know, and it tells me that this, I have to look at this list and look at these experiences from an entirely different angle. I think we should get into fear. Like, we've got to blast through fear and sex. Whoa. Just Do you mind if I just... Okay, awesome. Just briefly to get into fear, for me, it talks about how fear is the evil and corroding thread, and that we just need to ask ourselves, you know, one question when we're afraid is, you know, why are we so afraid? Because self-reliance is failing us. Of course I'm afraid. If I'm relying on self, I'm afraid. I should be afraid, right? Because I'm relying on self. And it tells me that I have to be on a different basis, trusting and relying upon God. And then again, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? Again, that doesn't mean that if I make a mistake, God is not going to enable me to match calamity with serenity. It's just I have to redouble my efforts. There's a great fear prayer. It says we ask God to remove, I'm totally like don't know where it is right now, but we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have me be. So again, that's a tool I use today in the moment. If I'm scared to do something, I say, God, please remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. And then I ask myself, what do I think God would have me be? If I'm scared to open up my bills, if I'm scared to make a phone call where I have to be direct, that's a big one for me. I hate being direct. It's very, you know, I'm scared that you'll be mad at me. So I think to myself, I believe that God would have me be a woman who is direct. Thanks. Steve, should we get into sex? Yeah. I mean, I'll keep.
Should we?
Let's do. I think, yeah, it's a very important.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're going to get into sex.
Great. Well, okay, I will start then. Yeah, so I love the sex inventory. I found it so helpful and so freeing. And what? Serious business. Okay, the first thing that I think is really important and was really a revelation to me is, you know, this idea that we all have sex problems. I think it's interesting that it's sex because for me, and I don't know about anyone else, but I've heard, you know, other people, you know, talk as well that sex is something that is so wrapped with shame and so wrapped with old ideas and what do you think of what I'm doing or, you know, I don't want you to know what I'm doing or just... you know, feeling ashamed and embarrassed. And what's so interesting is that when I did a sex inventory, I found that I wasn't only listing people that I'd had sex with. I mean, that was sort of had really nothing to do with it. It became like a relationship inventory almost. It became a picture into how I operate in sexual situations. You know, and it tells us we'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them on page 69? So again, it's not because just because I'm a sick alcoholic with a spiritual malady. It's because I'm a human being. You know, I get mixed up about sex. Okay, so it's telling me that I need to review my own conduct over the years past. And I'm just going to go through right now how I do a sex inventory. Does that sound good? Okay, so... just for example, this is what my inventory sheet would look like. It would be like, okay, who did I hurt, right? Okay, who did we hurt? I hurt, oh God, so funny. I'm totally having that paranoia that my stepsister, who's not even in the program, would hear this tape someday, but I'm just going to, it's fine. So I hurt my stepsister. What did I do is column two. I flirted and hooked up with her boyfriend when, you know, behind her back. What instincts of self caused me to do that? My self-esteem. I wanted his approval. I wanted to feel important. My sense of security. I felt like if I had him in my corner, it made me feel secure about myself. My ambitions to feel important as a young girl. I think that's just about it. Oh, and my pride, because I didn't want to look stupid and tell him that I wasn't comfortable with that. And again, it's not about the guy. It was about my sister, right? So then I say, okay, did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Well, probably jealousy because, you know, we had that chemistry then. When, you know, suspicion, definitely, because she'd come back in the room and there was that weird energy. Bitterness, probably. And then where was I at fault? What should I have done instead? That's where I write, okay, what did I do? Where was I at fault? Okay, what should I have done instead? I should have had enough self-esteem to tell him that I was uncomfortable with the situation. I should have valued my relationship with my sister you know, over getting this attention from this guy. I hope this isn't too self-revealing, but I find it really helpful when speakers share really specifically. So anyway, I've done it already, so there you go. But what is really interesting is that from that last column of what should I have done instead, that's where I get my sex ideal, right? Because it talks about, you know, however, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life, right? So that's a great tool right there. I have the sex inventory, and I've seen, like, the names don't even matter. I can get rid of those first two columns, cover them up. But what I see over and over and over again is, you know, didn't speak up, you know, lied, you know, should have, you know, valued my self-esteem and valued the relationship over getting the attention over and over and over again. And so then what do you think my future sex ideal is? Hello, you know, shouldn't have used him for money. You know, there's my future sex ideal. It's pretty simple. And then it gives us the test, you know, each relation to this test, is it selfish or not? Another thing that I love is that there's three prayers for sex, you know. Let's see, is God, please mold my ideals on 69. Please mold my ideas and ideals and help me to live up to them. Down at the bottom, in meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. So God, what should I do about this matter? And then I meditate on it. And then the third prayer is, you know, God, please, on 70, please give me the right ideal. Please give me guidance in this questionable situation for sanity and for strength to do the right thing. I think that what's really, just a quick story about the sex inventory is, I had an experience and it was probably like the summer before I came, or the February before I came to the Wilson house that first time. And I had an experience where I had a girlfriend who was long time sober in AA, and she was doing something with boys that I was like, oh, you know, I never got to do that. I came in young, you know, I'm going to do that too. I'm entitled. I can do that. So I had this experience and I tried this particular way of being in romantic relationships. And I called my sponsor the next day and I was like, oh, you're going to kill me. And she said, don't look at me. I've got nothing to do with your sex ideal. It's your sex ideal. How do you feel? And I was like, whoa. That's big. And what the book is telling us is that, you know, God, at this point, you know, I have to develop an inner God consciousness, that God is the real, God is the final judge, you know? And a lot of times I ask my sponsees, like, I don't know what you should do. How do you feel? How do you feel about what you did? You know, and again, that's what the book is directing us to do. And this part of, you know, the fourth step, it's all about clearing away those blocks so that I can hear. You know, it's not Ava, my sponsor, saying like, well, you shouldn't do that because blah, 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 blah. I've written like 80 pages of my inventory as my own evidence why these kinds of behaviors don't work for me. Steve?
It's important to note that it's not about how many people I slept with. In fact, it's about what did I use sex for. And so for me, my experience was, my truth is that it was just another form of control and manipulation. So did I have to have every woman on that list that I ever slept with? In my case, yes. But but the truth of the matter is, not necessarily. You know what I mean? If you all look and have a good time and there's nothing else attached to it, but if in fact, you know, I'm using that because I just want to get you so that I feel better, or if I just want to do this so that I can get closer to that one, if there's, you know, some motive other than, you know, my wanting to be with you, period. Yeah, you know what? You need to be on that list.
Also, one thing that, it brings it back to...
Excuse me one minute.
Yeah.
And the other part of that is, we have no judgment on that. You know, and so what I tell people when I work with them is, listen, this is between you and your God. You know, in the final analysis, it's just so that you get a real clear look at what you've been using sex for. And it's not its intended purpose. Just my opinion. And that is where this ends up.
And again, you know, it talks about, it brings it back again to, you know, the idea of there's the possibility of being shut off from the sunlight of the spirit when I engage in behaviors that are against that inner God. You know, that if you know, it says if we're sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. That's a huge warning. You know, and basically, you know, and then on down, what is the solution? You know, if I'm in a pickle with you know, a sex issue, a relationship issue, with anything, you know, and I don't know what to do. You know, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. So once again, you know, go be of service to another alcoholic. Just one last thing is the sex inventory. I've used that format too. I just to pass this on as another tool, I've used that format when I've made mistakes in other areas. Like if I, you know, I don't know, screwed up on a job, or I've used it as a way to sort of look at like, okay, well, what could I have done instead? You know, where was I at fault? What should I have done instead? Okay, so we're going to move into step 5 now.
And if you'd like a copy of that format, we have it. So just see us after the meeting.
Yep. So the book ends, how it works ends with that we have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. And it talks about, you know, an inventory of our grosser handicaps. So I just want to throw that out there. Sometimes people can get hung up, and I know I get hung up on like, did I really get every single resentment out? Did I really, you know, again, like, you know, I use that voice a lot because it's just how my brain sounds, you know, and I lived with that voice constantly 24 hours a day for like, you know, until last year. No, I'm just kidding. But basically what that's telling me is that the fourth step, it's an inventory of my grosser handicaps, the big chunks. Okay, so now we are into action. We are into the fifth step. So what have we been trying to do, Steve? Go.
It's important to note that four is not your life story. If they wanted your life story, they'd say write your life story. He's not asking you to write your life story. And in fact, when I'm working with people, I don't want to hear your life story. I don't have the time or the inclination. It's none of my business. You know, what we want is just the information. And it doesn't have to take 6 months or a year to do it. It was a joke that it used to take 2 years and 45 minutes. You know, 2 years to talk about it and 45 minutes to do it. No, and in fact, if you're sitting at my dining room table, you got 2 weeks. I want the big stuff. You know what? This isn't going to be the last one you do. You're going to go on to others. Mm-hmm. Before you're done, you have made an appointment with your sponsor to do five. Because you're talking to me as we're going through it. If I'm not your sponsor, you're talking to me about it. And, you know, I'm coaching you through this process. For us, just what where I come from, what we believe, your sponsor should have a sponsor. It talks in the book about using clergymen and others. And it's just my opinion and belief that when this book was written, we didn't have sponsors. So who else was there to go to? Now, I got to tell you, if you're going to go sit in a church, you're going to talk to a priest, he's going to say, good, go say a couple of Hail Marys, a couple of Our Fathers, you're done. That's not what we do. Okay? And so the point is that there are people, and listen, if you want to go to your priest, God bless you, I'm not here. Just my opinion. That when we sit down and we do this work with another alcoholic, with a sponsor that has a sponsor, he's going to have the ability to ask us some questions and get us to go places that we are not willing to go on our own. Okay? And ultimately, that's where we need to be. Don't forget, we're still in the early part of this work. It's ego deflating. And, you know, we need to get all of that out, all right, so that we are real clear about who we've been in the world. A sponsor will do that for you.
Again, you know, like I've been, you know, one of the things I really like is I like to look to the places in the book that are all about right now and how we can use these tools right now. You know, in the beginning, at the top of 72, here's what we've been doing. Okay, so we made the personal inventory. We've been trying to get a new attitude, new relationship with a creator, and to discover, you know, what's blocking us. We've admitted certain defects. Okay, so we kind of have an idea what the trouble is. Okay, look at this word now. You know, I have this ring around now. These are about to be cast out. I love that. I just want to point that out. So what we're going to do now is we have to take action and you know, admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. So, you know, I for a long time could admit that I did certain things. But I didn't really understand the exact nature. I didn't understand what was driving me to do those things. I didn't understand that it was my need for self-esteem. I didn't understand that it was my, you know, it was, you know, that I was a fear-based person. I didn't understand really what the exact nature of my problems were. You know, I knew that I did these things, you know, I just felt bad about them, you know, until I didn't anymore. You know, and again, bottom of 72, it says the best reason, you know, it talks about why we can't skip this vital step. The best reason first, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. And it talks about newcomers trying to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. When I did my first fifth step, again, I did it with, there's just a little side story that I just love to share. I did it with Annette, and Annette was, like I said, she had sometimes a hard time hearing. And so I'd be telling her these, you know, these things that I felt so ashamed about. And I'd tell her, you know, I stole my dad's wallet. Huh? And I stole money from my dad's wallet. Huh? You know, so pretty soon I stole money from my dad's wallet. You know, like I'd be yelling these things, you know, the third time, like it just has no sting. I'm like, you know, I'm beat. I don't care. You know, there's like no secretiveness, basically. And one thing that she did, you know, and this line reminds me of it in particular is she said, you know, she taught me how to write the inventory, you know, resentments, fears, and sex. And then she said, and if you have any secrets, write them down. And there were three secrets that I had that I had never told anyone. They were, you know, those things that I don't know if anybody here else had them, but they were like those weird whispers that you have in your brain, those things that I'd think about, you know, late at night. And, I didn't think I'd ever tell anybody. And I told her, and I've had that experience with people whose fifth step I've heard. And it's amazing. The freedom that you get, also, one thing about the fifth step, you know, this is, for me, the fifth step is so much about becoming an integrated person. You know, it talks about on 73, the alcoholic leading a double life. I led like a quintuple life, you know, like I was this person with that group. I was this person with that group. You know, I did this, you knew this about me, you know, and when I did my fifth step, it was the first time that one person knew everything about me, you know, and you know, those fifth step promises that come, you know, a page or two later, they talk about being able to look the world in the eye. It was the first time that I started to feel the beginning of that integration. Another thing about the fifth step, you know, Steve and I both, we exchanged little tools that we have in taking a fifth step, and Steve has a great tool, and I'll share this little tool that Annette gave to me, is the red pen, right? The red pen. So my sponsees know about the red pen. So one thing that I've found in practical experience and the way the fifth step was done with me is that it's not about me getting together with my sponsor and basically purging while she takes a nap on the couch, you know? It's not about, you know, me just like reading. And I mean, this is just for me. I found that, and I found in taking fifth steps that it's a conversation, you know, because there's certain things that I know that when I wrote them out, you know, I followed the directions, but I still didn't really, you know, I needed my sponsor's insight. So what was so great, and what has been so great every time I do inventory with my sponsor or with any other member, is that it's a, you know, it's a conversation. And so Annette taught me to use the red pen. She gave me a red pen when we were doing the fifth step. And I wrote in the insights that we came up with together, the insights that she gave me. And so whenever, before I'm doing a fifth step with a sponsee, I say, oh, let's get the red pen. And it's really a great little tool, Steve.
There's also...
So whenever, before I'm doing a fifth step with a sponsee, I say, oh, let's get the red pen. And it's really a great little tool, Steve.
There's also when we're writing, well, I will specifically ask, you know, after you're done with resentments, institutions, principles, fears, sex, fine. Now I want to know everything that you were going to take to your grave. And I also want to know everyone that you have ever harmed that had, you didn't have to have a resentment with. There's just a whole host of people that we've harmed. And so when we sit down to do five, I'm going to share something else with you that if you're one of mine and you're doing a fifth step and I'm going to hear your fifth step, You may come to my house, and I may ask you to take a ride, and I will not tell you where we're going until we get to my sponsor's house. And I'll say, what are we doing here? And I'll say, well, you know, you're going to share your fifth step with he and I and whoever else. And he's a firm believer in that. And so if you want to talk about ego deflating, and the question is, how free do you want to be? There you go. And there's your answer.
Right.
And then we say, okay, see you later. And that's harsh. And it makes a lot of people uncomfortable. And it's not uncommon for him to ask his female sponsees if they would have their fifth steps heard with a strange male present. And it gets to that place where you say, how free do you want to be? Now, I'll tell you that I've listened to, I don't want to say hundreds, but lots. And there just isn't too much going on. Piques my curiosity. I mean, the truth of the matter is, I'd like to hear a good one, you know, but, you know, and you all think that your stuff is just like, oh, my God, trust me. Having sat on the other side of them, garden variety. And that's true. And I recently sat with a sponsee, brought a 19-year-old girl, and her sponsee, and she sat and she did her fifth, you know, including sex and fear, and that's just what we do. Not like it's an event, not like it's a big deal. It's how free do you want to be? And so when you're done with that process, trust me, you are not tied to your past. You know, you have just taken all the power out of your story. And you got three other people sitting there looking at you saying, is that all you got? You know. The other thing that's important is, you know, while you're talking, you have a legal pad and you have a pen, because I am not one of those people that believes that everybody that's in four belongs on eight. Some people do say, just use your fourth. I am not one of those people. There are people on that list that I have wronged that I need to make amends to. And there are people on that list that I'm just angry with and I just had business with. You know, there's a distinction, and it's important to note that distinction.
5 minutes. Okay. You know, I think that one of the things that also the book talks about is that, you know, this fifth step is, it's on 75. It talks about how it's a life and death errand. You know, and it really is. I have to bring these things into the light. You know, if I really, you know, if I want to get sober. You know, and you know, the care that was taken with me when I did my first fifth step was, it really spoke to that. You know, she treated it like it was a life and death errand. And I try to treat it the same way. Like it is a life and death errand. And it's amazing because, I mean, I've experienced seeing people change before my eyes. You know, and sometimes it's funny, you know, ideally, like for me, I like to take a whole day and do it. But a lot of times, you know, the fifth steps last like a couple days, like a couple, several, you know, sessions of several hours. One thing that I do too is, before we begin a fifth step is, I really like this idea that when I'm working with a sponsee is that there's a third party in the room, and that third party is God. You know, it's something that Annette really taught me too. We would pray together before we started our work. She would always say, God, this is I and Heidi. And, you know, and it made me feel so comforted, and I try to do that with my sponsees because what it tells me and what it does for me is that it's not just my stuff and their stuff duking it out, you know. Sorry, just there's a third party there, you know, that's a buffer, you know, and that can contain all of that stuff, because I'm just a human power, you know, with all my limited experience, strength, and hope, you know, and they're just a human power. But there's, you know, there's one that has all power, and that's God. You know, actually, you know, we can just wrap up. just take a look at those fifth step promises on 75. You know, once we've taken this step, we can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears will fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We begin to have a spiritual experience. So this is, you know, the feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. This is the beginning of our spiritual experience. So with that, I guess we're gonna close, right? And do we have a little time? I think we might.
Do I have a choice?
Yeah, I think we're going to close. But we did want to actually invite, for those of you who are interested, we want to do the third step in the way that Steve described. So if you're interested in that, I was thinking I think we have a little break right now. I was thinking we'd go outside and split into two groups. And we can spontaneously take the third step together if you want.
Would anyone like to join us? Show hands. Great.
Cool. See you outside. Thanks a lot.